Hello and welcome to Mind in Mind. My name is Jane O'Rourke. I'm a child, adolescent and family psychotherapist. Mind in Mind is a new podcast. We're featuring interviews with the world's leading clinicians working in child mental health, sharing what they know about what best helps children and families. On our website, mindinmind.org.uk, you'll also find videos of our interviews and our guest bloggers writing about the latest research and innovation to give depth of thinking to topical issues in child and family mental health. We're beginning our interviews with the pioneers of child psychotherapy, the founding greats who started their careers learning from the likes of Anna Freud, Donald Winnicott, Melanie Klein, and John Bowlby. They've been working with children for decades and are responsible for establishing some of the first children's therapy services and developing theories and ideas which shape our clinical thinking today. It's not an exaggeration to say that Dilys Dawes' contribution to the field of child mental health and child psychotherapy has been immense. Spanning over five decades, her career as a child and adolescent psychotherapist is notable in many respects. As a clinician, and shaping public opinion and government policy about the importance of infant mental health. In the 1980s, Dilys began speaking to the public and government about the work of child psychotherapists, raising awareness of the profession and the problems babies and parents experience in a way that had never been done before. Her books, such as Through the Night, have become classics for therapists and new parents alike. Their popularity is perhaps due to the fact that they're based on 50 years of careful observation of babies and their families, many of them spent in the same baby clinic. There's no doubt that Dilys' ability to influence government policy and collaborate with different child professions is really quite remarkable and marks her out as one of the most important child psychotherapists of her generation. But perhaps it's her extraordinary clinical work in the James Wigg GP practice in Kentish Town in North London which draws the most admiration and respect of her colleagues and has inspired generations of child therapists, doctors, health visitors and social workers. Because since 1976, each week Dilys has been transforming the lives of children and parents in what might be to some an unconventional setting for therapeutic work. I asked her why she chooses to stand by the weighing scales, observing what takes place as parents bring in their babies to be checked.
It's a really useful place to be because it's where the first activity of the baby clinic is. So I'm visible, in fact, to the health visitors and the doctors working in the clinic. And it helps them to think, sort of noticing me, it helps them to think about who might need help with the emotions of being new parents.
So it's as much for fellow clinicians.
Yes, very much so. And in fact, I don't see patients sort of on the spot, but I'm there for the health visitors and the doctors to make referrals to me to see them, yes.
But you're very much observing what's happening between the parent and the baby when they bring in the baby to be weighed.
Yes. And you can see a great deal, actually, of what the relationship is like, simply of how parents undress their baby, how they put them on the weighing scales, how much the baby looks at them or looks away, all that sort of thing, yes. And I can point it out to the health visitors.
Mm. You've written it takes as much skill to stand next to a weighing machine as it does not to talk during a psychotherapy session.
Yes. It's quite difficult to be an outsider in another place of work. So I come from the Tavistock Clinic to a place where I'm not a full-time member of staff there.
So there's difficulties in being an outsider. Do you want to say more about that?
Yes. And once when I was giving a paper to the Tavistock about the work, I think it was Sebastian Kramer who asked me, what do you need to do this kind of work? And I jokingly said, a very thick skin, yes. And it does, you actually have to manage being an outsider, but actually doing some quite difficult work on the inside.
Yes. Mm. Now, many people might not see this as psychotherapy, and perhaps in particular not psychoanalytic psychotherapy. And you've been clearly being able to be bold in how you do your clinical work.
I've been bold, and I also think that I quite consciously suggested to other professions that they be braver in doing what they do. And I think one of the main things that I've been able to do is to help other professionals not to react directly, immediately to the problems that the patients, the families bring, but to actually wait and ask them to tell them more about it. So instead of saying, have you tried so-and-so to solve a problem, to say, tell me more about it.
Mm. So it provides a thinking space.
Yes.
So tell us more about the families you have helped.
It's what it's been is families who have come in the baby clinic to their doctor or their health visitor with problems about excessive crying, sleeping, feeding, and also quite a lot of mothers coming and saying that they're having problem with bonding with their baby. And it's the people who haven't been able to just use the ordinary good advice from the doctor and health visitor. They then refer some of those on to me. Yeah.
Now, we'll be talking more about your ideas about what might lead a parent to come to somebody like you with a baby who's experienced problems with crying or feeding or not sleeping. But I'm interested, what led you into this particular field of work as a child psychotherapist?
It was something very personal. When I had my second baby, there were some feeding problems. And in fact, my marriage was in difficulties at that point. And I actually went back to the psychoanalyst who I'd seen when I was training as a child psychotherapist and talked to her about the problems. But I thought, if I wasn't in this field and had somebody to go and talk to, who would I have talked to about it? And that's when I had the idea of actually me or somebody like me being available in a baby clinic. Yeah.
So you experienced the help that you'd received yourself, and you were able to make some connections with your present experience and perhaps past experience.
Yes. Yeah. And I've never forgotten that.
Mm-hmm. And that's fueled you in wanting to help other parents.
Yes. And it's also fueled me in knowing that people don't need much help very often. That if they have a viable life already, just a bit of understanding can actually help them sort out current problems. Yeah.
And I know that you had a particular role model, or maybe role models, in your practice as a child psychotherapist growing up.
Yes, my parents, yes. My mother was a very good mother, and I hope I passed on some of what I learned from her to my children. And also that it's quite difficult to be a parent, yeah. Doesn't stop being, yes. But my father was a GP working from home in Huddersfield, and I could see that the work was really exciting and useful, and I wanted to be a doctor when I grew up. Fortunately, the point when I had done my O-levels, I realised that I wasn't really going to be good at doing a medical training. And what I did do was to go on to university to do social anthropology. But meanwhile, after the war, the Second World War, ended, my father did a psychiatric training commuting from Huddersfield, where we lived then, to Manchester. And I was 12 by then, and it was a psychiatric training that had quite a psychoanalytic basis to it. And so there was Freud on the dining room table as I grew up. And that actually, really influenced me. My father then was working in child guidance, and after I'd graduated and was wondering what to do, he actually suggested that he knew Anna Freud, and told me about child psychotherapy, and said, "Why don't you go and be one of Anna Freud's young ladies," which is what they were called at the time. And I did, in fact, apply to the Anna Freud Centre and wasn't accepted, and then later applied to the Tavistock and was, and trained there quite young.
Yeah. So you were, did you say, was it 23 you started?
I was 25. I started, which is much younger than most people, are accepted these days. And was too young, really. I hadn't had enough experience. But I had had some very, the sort of few years that I had of working was actually, I worked at, for one point, at the Institute of Community Studies in Bethnal Green, where really very star people, sociologists, like Peter Townsend, Peter Wilmot, were working. It was run by Michael Young. So I had a really good background in social sciences before I trained as a child psychotherapist. And that's enabled me, I think, always to think of the context.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps having that early days sort of that's been really grounded in many ways in giving service to others, had a big impact on you through your parents, and then that early training in a wide field. And I know that you studied anthropology at university. Perhaps that's enabled you to be able to sort of think very broadly about child psychotherapy and how you work. And I know that you were one of the first child psychotherapists to break the taboo of speaking to the media. Why did you decide to do that? And you encouraged others to as well, other psychotherapists, to speak to the media too about child mental health.
What I thought was, they don't know what you don't tell them. And that we had a whole lot of knowledge that we were circulating within our own profession and weren't telling people outside, yes. And particularly politicians and civil servants, I thought, didn't know what we didn't tell them, yes, and found people really delighted to hear about it, yeah.
So, what struck me an awful lot about your writing is, and particularly for parents, is that you don't blanch from confronting the emotional turmoil that is the reality for most parents at some stage. And in particular, you describe things like jealousy and hatred that can arise between parents, and even the desire many parents feel to hurt their babies even. Why is it important, do you feel, to acknowledge negative emotions?
Because they're just as important as positive ones, and just as universal. And you really miss out of the whole sort of meaning of relationships if you don't acknowledge the conflicts that one has.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. And if you don't acknowledge the conflict, what happens?
That things just get repressed and a whole dimension of relationships doesn't happen. Mm-hmm.
Mm. And that then impairs the relationship between parents and their babies?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How important has psychoanalysis been in informing your practice?
Very much so. First of all, doing a training that was based on on psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic ideas and on the unconscious and knowing what's happening underneath and how important early experiences and relationships are really for the rest of one's life. Yes.
There are probably not many parenting books that share psychoanalytic theory or psychoanalytic ideas, but that is clearly important to you. For example, you describe for parents Winnicott's Maternal Preoccupation, The Good Enough Mother, Juliet Hopkins' Too Good Mothering. Why do you think it's helpful for parents to know about these sort of ideas?
Because they exist and they really colour what is going on between us. But it's not just me that's been doing that. I think the Freud's ideas have actually got into the culture, and everybody, in a way, now knows about the Oedipus complex, about slips of the tongue that one makes, you know, what the meaning is. And I used to tell government ministers when I was speaking to them that they knew less than some of the ordinary public knows who watch EastEnders and Coronation Street, which actually are about relationships and about the effects that people have on each other and that experiences have. So it's not all in academic writing. Mm. It's there for the public.
Yeah. Mm. What really comes across in your writings for parents is your urging to them to really observe their babies, to attend in detail to what's happening in the moment, and perhaps crucially, what feelings are being aroused in them too. And that sounds very much like the job that we as child psychotherapists need to do. Why is it important for parents to do this as well?
Because babies are actually trying to communicate. And they're communicating pre-verbally just as much as when they learn to speak. And they're letting parents know what they're feeling. And you can see it if you look. Yes.
Whilst there's much for parents to learn, another psychoanalytic idea emerges in your writings for them, which is the value of not knowing and a sense of bearing with difficulty.
Yes, it is, and of not having to know better, I think, than somebody else. I think that's what's important, yeah.
There's a lot of competitive parenting.
Yes, yes, and you don't have to know better than your children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, it's been mothers for whom early years help has been directed, but you have fathers very much in your sights. You emphasise their importance in their relationship with their babies, as well as supporting their partners, and the benefits babies derive from that triangulation that happens, and the impact that has on their emerging sense of self.
Yes, it's really important to have the creative, where there are two parents, the creativeness of having two different points of view. Not hostile ones, but ones where there are two different, and they don't necessarily have to fit together, and actually being able to stand that, you know, there are two different minds there, and it's also important, of course, for the parents and babies to be able to have different views on things. Yeah. And babies at a certain point near the end of the first year learn, as Daniel Stern said, that there are other minds out there. And the parents need to really accept and respect that the babies has another mind and has a different view on things, yes.
So that might be a difficulty for babies growing up in one-parent households.
Yes, it is. So single parents need to have other family members, friends, colleagues at work or whatever, who can be around for the baby as well as themselves. Mm. Yeah.
The early years can be challenging for both mothers and fathers, yet you have pointed to research that indicates that a father of a young baby is often more likely to work longer hours than other men, which might be a response to perhaps difficult feelings aroused by the birth of the baby.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's one way that fathers sometimes, of new babies, sometimes cope is by having reasons to leave all the emotions at home and go out and do something else.
Mm-hmm. And it, perhaps that's connected with the value that society places on parenting, that there is a double standard. I think you said in your latest book that on the one hand it's sort of almost mystified, and at the other hand it's really not valued as well.
Yes, I think so. So they go to a job where they're respected.
Yeah. You've written widely about the most common difficulties experienced by babies, such as feeding and sleep problems with sleeping through the night, crying. In your paper, The Perils of Intimacy, you urge clinicians where there are problems with feeding, for example, to address the unmet needs of the parents. Why is it important for clinicians to do that?
Because quite often, if there are two kinds of feeding difficulties. One is feeding too much, and the other is neglect and feeding too little. And both of those actually may come from problems in the parents' own childhood. Now, the feeding too little, actual neglect of babies, often comes from the parent having actually suffered neglect themselves and not feeling they have any resources to give to the baby. And they actually need some support themselves to actually feel looked after and nourished by a professional that they can then pass on to their baby. But strikingly, feeding a baby too much can actually be because of a fear of separation, a feeling that saying no or stopping or not giving that much more is neglect of their baby. Mm-hmm. And those parents have often suffered a separation themselves.
So a bereavement
or a loss of some kind, yes. Mm-hmm. And actually making the connection themselves often actually helps them to change their behaviour without even having to sort of decide to do so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And those early traumas suffered by parents, the ghosts in the nursery, as Selma Freiberg described them, can really impair relationships if they're not, perhaps the parents are not helped by clinicians to make those connections.
Yes, and just telling the story sometimes is all that's needed. It's striking how little help parents sometimes need to actually change how things are.
But it's a difficult thing perhaps to approach parents with if you have a feeling that there might be an early trauma. How do you approach what can be a very difficult subject for parents?
Simply saying, how was it for you? And sometimes, even in the first session, they can feel that they trust you enough to tell you something. Or that the feeling of trust that they're getting perhaps enables them to start to sort of remember consciously what things were like and to be able to tell the story to themselves as well as telling it to the therapist.
You talk in detail about breastfeeding. It's a subject that still arouses a lot of feelings and controversy. Whilst in most parenting books the practicalities are the focus, you talk about the complexity of feelings aroused and even perhaps what might be taboo feelings, such as sensual pleasures of breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. It is a very sensual activity and some people feel a bit afraid of it, yes, and feel they shouldn't be feeling like that. Mm-hmm. And then there is the opposite of actually feeling they're not sure that they wanted this baby anyway, and they're not sure they want it sort of latched on to them, and actually learning how to manage the closeness, the emotional closeness, can then help manage the physical closeness.
Mm-hmm. And you've written about that closeness and the proximity to how close a parent can allow a baby to be when they're feeding. And I know that when a baby is being fed at a distance, that often rings an alarm bell. And at the same time, a baby that feels too close to the mother is not able to have its own sense of agency. Can be a problem too, can't it?
Yes, and as the baby is growing up and is being weaned, of actually allowing that separateness. But it was John Bowlby who wrote first about the proximity necessary for feeding, for looking after a baby, that leads to love. Yes. So you have the baby close, and that's what brings the feelings out.
Mm-hmm. So you help parents to, in some cases, to able to bring their babies closer so the connection can be made?
I hope so. I don't often get a referral soon enough because I don't work in the hospital where the first feeding usually happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you had your time again, you'd be...
And I'd be there as well.
Yes.
How many places to be in.
Yes.
But one of the things that I've hoped to do by setting up the Association for Infant Mental Health is drawing in all the different professions who work with parents at different stages.
For many busy clinicians who are under increasing pressure to see as many people as possible, what might be interesting is the value you place on not immersing yourself too much in clinical work at the expense of connecting with the rest of the clinical team. Why is that important?
Because the thoughts that I have about some of the parents, by passing those on to the workers, very often they don't need to refer patients to me. They can actually do the work themselves.
And I suppose this would apply to other clinicians working in the context of schools, other places where there is a team of people around.
Very much so. That actually passing on the ideas is as important as seeing that families directly.
In the 1980s, you were involved in negotiating with the government for organised training for child psychotherapists in the National Health Service. Why was that important to you?
What I did was actually helping them to know about child psychotherapy, and actually some other colleagues did the actual negotiating. But it was really important because child psychotherapists were working in the NHS but had to find ways of funding themselves to do the training. And that was extraordinary. And the easy analogy that we made to the government was that doctors didn't have to do that, and that medical training was just, of course, funded and established within the NHS.
Those funded posts are still going.
Yes.
But there's often a feeling that they're under threat.
Yes, very much so now. All the cuts in the NHS are endangering child psychotherapy, yes.
And endangering child psychotherapy, what's going to be the impact for children and families?
There have been television programmes about this recently, of showing how children in really quite dangerous states of mind are not even able to get onto waiting lists to be seen, yes, and not able to be offered treatment, which can be very successful, yeah. And that starting, instead of the idea that you have to be at a very serious stage of mental difficulty, actually seeing people early on is much more effective.
So almost 60 years of clinical work, what are the most important things that you would like to pass on to other child psychotherapists, in particular perhaps those who are just starting out?
I think always thinking about a child as within the family context and never seeing a child for psychotherapy without they themselves or somebody else working with the families. Mm-hmm. You don't get very far by helping a child to change and not supporting the parents.
Thank you very much, Dilys. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Dilys Dawes. You can find more information about Dilys's rich career, her writings, and also the video version of this interview on our website, mindinmind.org.uk. You'll also find interviews with other leading child psychotherapists, such as Gianna Placa-Williams, Juliet Hopkins, and Monica Laniardo. Check out our guest bloggers writing about the latest research and innovation to give depth of thinking to topical issues in child and family mental health. Thanks very much for listening.